This process is part of our continuing ed, and with Lori here giving us some input on pastoral resiliency. I met Lori at an event at Princeton. She's a Princeton grad. She works primarily with Presbyterian Church USA contexts, but she's from Bethlehem, although she lives in the lower Hudson Valley outside of New York City. She also works with Phil Berge at Auburn Seminary, working as a coach and a coaching instructor. I found her input to be among the best at my week of training when I was at Princeton, and wanted to bring her here to be with you, especially as we're moving into the Lilly Grant, and also her experience in working with Lilly processes. A couple things just to highlight, some things that we can recognize that God has enabled us to do over the last years. We set some goals of maintaining longer pastoral presence, pastoral tenure in our churches about 7 or 8 years ago. We had a series or a time period where there was frequent transition, that there was too often shorter pastoral terms, which we recognize is not always healthy with congregations. I think collaboratively between the Spirit's work, some work around the pastoral search processes, also a number of things that have come into play, we are actually at a place where we've met that goal of extending pastoral tenure. At the same time, increasing the diversity, age diversity, men, women, and ethnic diversity within our pastoral roles of 100 people. So that's something to note that the Spirit is doing among us. I often feel like in my role, if God is only helping us get the right person to the right place, that sometimes feels like more than enough. Now we know that it requires the Spirit to sustain, but I'm grateful for that. Lori, we're grateful for you to be here today to work with us over the next hour and a half. Thanks for your willingness to lead us in what you're learning, working alongside leaders and helping us to increase our depth, increase our wisdom, and hopefully increase the capacity that we have to extend God's dream. Thank you.
So I jumped to my table that you're already going to the margins by bringing in a Presbyterian to work with you on resilience. It's been a very rich and full morning, and I appreciate your invitation to me, and I really appreciate the ability to listen in on what you're learning, what you're doing, and how you are working in your congregations and communities to extend. It's great to overhear. There are so many similarities, even though obviously we're extremely well paid. There are still a lot of similarities between the work you all are about and the challenges that you all are about. And that's really what has led me in my work. I was a parish pastor for about 20 years and then went back to school to study differently. And as God invites us on journeys that we don't expect, I ended up doing work and study around the idea of hardiness and resilience. I actually like to say that Phil Berge works with me. And I think he might not if he were here. But one of the things we begin to see with our coaching work is how do we help leaders and how do we help congregations really develop that sense of resilience to be in the challenging times that we are. So as we begin, just from where you are, when you hear that sense, building resilience, or you think about cultivating resilience, what are some of the things that might come up for you? Like just ideas or associations?
Self-care.
Avoiding burnout. Yep.
Flexibility. Healthy practices.
So I do two pieces of work on this. I do a piece that's really around pastoral resilience, but with Steve's experience at Princeton was about personal resilience. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about, organizational resilience. So I'm going to be talking about organizational resilience today more than pastoral resilience, but there are pieces that overlap and we'll be going through that. So the times that we are in are nothing if not volatile. And how would you describe, what does volatile mean to you?
Uncertainty.
Explosive.
Stressful and anxious. Absolutely. And where do you see volatility as you look around you?
I think
we could be holistic and say our political process is profoundly volatile right now. Profoundly volatile. Yeah. Where else do you see volatility? That kind of unpredictable or explosive?
The economy.
The economy. Absolutely. Other places? Yeah, I mean, they're going along just fine, and then out of nowhere, right? Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I really do believe as the volatility gets more intense around us, so we've sort of talked nationally. I think the international volatility is frightening for many people. We may not be personally experiencing that, but all we have to do is flip on our television sets and we are reminded endlessly about how volatile things are. And I then think in our closer communities, things begin to reverberate at that same, because people do feel stressed and uncertain and frightened. So that really contributes to it. And volatility, I used to talk about how what we're dealing with is change. Yeah, but it's such a banal word when really volatility to me is we're going along sort of, we think we're doing okay, and then before you know it, there's something we didn't expect. And it almost comes out of nowhere. And so how do we, as leaders and as faithful people, how do we begin to navigate that? Because I really think it's not going to be any different, right? We really are in a position where, and how do we navigate it personally? So I think the work you all are doing around the financial thing is a way to begin to say, how are we going to help our leaders navigate and stay resilient? But it's also, how do we navigate as communities? How do we do the things that we are meant to do? Because I think one of the things maybe in the back of our mind we've had is a sense that, well, you know, when things calm down, right? Like, when we get through the election, it'll be, right? I don't think so. When we get through this stewardship cycle and things calm down, when we get through whatever it is, we'll have some kind of period. But it seems that these cycles are getting tighter. And so the question really is, it's here to stay. Whether we like it or not, this is going to be our reality, at least for the next how many years? So how do we do that? So this is just a way that I like to illustrate what's going on.
Some people like to climb mountains. I like to build planes in the air.
I grew up wanting to be on a wing, wanting to be up this high.
Sometimes the temperature up at altitude will reach 60 below. It's brisk, it's refreshing.
You never know what you're going to come across up here. Canadian geese, mallards,
owls.
These people back here, that's why I come to work. That's why I build airplanes in the sky.
We're not just building a plane here. We're building a dream.
I love this job.
I get a lot of thanks up here. When I look over there and I see that little kid, the look in his eyes, that's all the thanks I need.
So in terms of what we're talking about, volatility, what did you see in that? Probably most of you have seen that clip before, but it always just reminds me of in a sense, what we're up about. What did you hear or see that connected with you, made you smile or made you think? Those people needed to be committed to what they were doing. You bet they did. Yeah. They were fearless. Well, and you know, along with the commitment and the fearlessness, one of the lines I love, I don't know how easy it was to hear, but he says, I love my job. I love my job. Like, it's refreshing up here. One of the things I love most about this is nobody's whining. Oh, my gosh, why do we have to do it in the air? Why are we up here? Why are we doing this now? Couldn't we? You know, and I don't know about how it happens in your pastoral circles, but in the pastoral circles that I work in, there tends to be some whining. We have to do this now. So they're committed, they're fearless, and they love their jobs. They have a purpose. And they have parachutes. They do have parachutes. Yeah. Yeah. And they're thinking of the future generations. We see, when I see that little boy's face, right? And there was another line in there that is really meaningful. Right. Exactly. Right. And a compelling vision that invites them to do something where they're committed and fearless, and they see the future. And yes, they have parachutes, but parachutes don't always work, you know. So, I mean, they're still taking enormous risks to do something that they believe in. So it always feels enlivening to me when I remember that really is actually the call that we have, to be doing something that is, you know, deeply risky and also deeply meaningful for others, for the future. Yeah. We are about a foolish task. And why do it in the air? We just have to work with the times we have. Right? If times were different, perhaps we could. But as I look at the most exciting and the most growth-fueled times in Christendom, they seem to be the times when the church is in the air. You know, not when the church is stuck on the ground, but when things are, you know, when it's really moving, we tend to be in the air. And so, you know, the foolishness of God, I think, is also about who God calls to do the work, as we look around each other and we say, well, thank heavens we're here. So all of that says to me to kind of set that big stage about where we are living and how we are living and how we're doing ministry. That really sets the stage for the work of cultivating resilience, and cultivating resilience as, again, in our congregations. So we started doing this maybe a little as I asked you what you thought about resilience, but how would you, as you think about your congregation or your conference or even your denomination or even Protestant church in America, however you want to think of it, how would you define resilience?
I would say getting up again after you've been knocked down and just getting up again.
Right. Right. That's a classic definition of resilience, the ability to come back after a setback or a trauma or something, that comeback ability, for sure. How else would you define resilience? Adapting to a new reality. So there's an adaptation. Somebody before mentioned the word flexibility. So there's an adaptation or flexibility. The thing, it comes from a French word meaning to bounce. And so if you think about it, that coming back or that flexibility has to do with there is almost a physical sense to the word, that how do we have that physicality that can come into a new situation. So that's actually absolutely a part of it, and that tenacity or that grit, that not giving up, is, I think, you know, one of the reasons I love this graphic is that resilience isn't just one thing. So it's combined of these kind of characteristics. It's our beliefs and it's our habits or practices that come together. It isn't just one thing that makes us resilient. And when we think about our congregations, when we think about that, it really is a combination of things that leads to resilience.
I think the tree that's deeply rooted and weathered the storm.
Okay, so there's that deeply rootedness, and we're going to get to that really has a big deal to, so that resilience is both the ability to move, and you're not resilient if you're not rooted, right? If you're just tossed around, if you're just all over the place, that's not resilient. So it has that deep root and the flexibility of a tree is a great image.
Elasticity.
Mm-hmm. So that elasticity is that bounce, right? So if you think about your congregations in this context, you know, to just kind of sort of do a mental scan, you know, how resilient do you feel your congregation is? Maybe as a whole, maybe your leadership teams, your own staff, you know, to just kind of like where would you all be on that? Is it a fairly resilient group in this definition, or is it? And we're going to go through some of the things that make it up. When I first started studying this, I was studying hardiness and resilience, again, personal resilience and leadership resilience for pastors. And I believe it's also true for organizations. And one of the things I love most about it is that this is not, you know, in our psychological parlance, it is a state, not a trait. Meaning, if it's a trait, you have it or you don't, right? They often think maybe optimism or pessimism is more of a trait. But in fact, resilience is a state. And that means it's something that we can grow, we can cultivate, we can nurture. And there are practices to do that. It's not you have it or you don't. You can learn to be resilient. And you know, when you did that sort of kind of check-in about your congregations, your leadership teams can learn to be more resilient for these times. There are ways we can do that. And we're going to talk about what those four, I pulled four practices out of some of the literature about it to talk about how we can help our congregations practice and learn to be resilient. That being said, because it is a state, another thing to keep in mind is we can build it up. You're nodding. Where am I going? Right.
I was actually going to raise my hand and say, I think for some in the Mennonite church, you know, congregation is 300 years old.
Right.
We've been here this long, so of course we'll.
Right. Exactly. So you, and we can lose it, and usually the way we lose it is we spend it. Right? So when you have something come along that is a crisis, or if you are 300 years long and you have spent it without attending to the practices that build it, it will diminish. It will dissipate. So it dissipates, you know, if you don't use it. And when you do use it, you use it up. So coming back to these practices are ways to build it up again. And the same is true for all of you as leaders. There are times you maybe feel like you've got some natural resilience. You know, you're a natural bounce back kind of person. But if you have a series of things that happen, and financial crises are one of them, or you can have lots of things that happen, you begin to spend it down. So then you do, back to the question of self-care, how do you build it up? So I'm using a definition from a book by the name of a guy named Andrew Zolli. He wrote a book called Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. He wanted to study it. I don't generally recommend that you run out and get this book because he could have used an editor. Has anybody here read it, seen it? It's a great series of examples of resilience in organizations, but he has one of those minds like Velcro where he just gathers stories from all over and things that happen, and you know, by the second chapter you've heard about so many different things you can't even quite keep track. So if you like that kind of like thinking, this book is for you. If you like something that's a little more ordered, you know, following a thread, it's probably not for you. But I find his research very compelling. So this is his definition, that resilience is the capacity of a system, enterprise, or person to maintain its core purpose and integrity. So back to that rootedness. To maintain its core purpose and integrity in the face of dramatically changed circumstances. And I don't know what else might describe faith community more than this. Right? How do we maintain our core purpose and integrity in the face of dramatically changed and changing, you know, because what had changed 3 or 4 years ago is now changing as we move in tomorrow. I mean, again, that rapidity of that. So any thoughts or comments about that definition?
Get us where we need to be. And so because we believe
Absolutely. Right. They have their core purpose, exactly. Right.
Coming here, I was thinking resilience in a positive way. When I see that definition, and if we're working with a system or within a system that is not healthy, they also can be resilient, and it's really hard to change the structure or change the system, whether it be a church or a conference or a denomination or City of Allentown's government or the school system, which I'm thinking about. Then resilient in their core purpose, which is fundamentally, I think, anti-Jesus, but it's hard. They're resilient.
That's a, you know, that I have never thought about that, and that is such a helpful addition, right? So resilience in and of itself is not necessarily. I mean, it's the core purpose that makes it, whether it's a good thing or just, or whether, you know, or whether you're dealing with Crown Vetch, right? I mean, Crown Vetch is resilient. I mean, you think about the weeds, you know, they, and I mean real weeds, not things that we could actually eat and think of as weeds, but I mean things that really are invasive species. So it's a helpful way to think about that. We can be, in our core purpose, dealing with something that, yeah, is very resilient and tends to come back. Yeah, that's interesting. Thank you. Yeah.
That touched on my question, and maybe this is where you're going with this, but to maintain core purpose and integrity, my question is, so how do you make adjustments along the way if all you're thinking about is keeping it?
Great. It's such a great question. Right, exactly, and so, and we are gonna. Can we hold that? Because you, absolutely, right. What does that mean? So I pulled from his work. And another person, Judith Roden, who works with the Rockefeller Foundation, wrote a book called The Resilience Dividend: Being Strong in a World Where Things Go Wrong. She did this after a lot of work that was being done in Manhattan after Hurricane Sandy, And again, that idea, if you have some resilience in the bank, if you have that resilience dividend, you're ready, you have some bounce when things come along, and how do you create that? Again, this is a kind of a complicated but useful book. So I pulled four practices out, and I'm going to tell you the four, and then we'll go back in and go through them. So the first one, and we've already hit on it, because it really is the key to the whole piece, which is you define core purpose throughout the system. Which means everyone in the organization has to know the core purpose. So when you all were working this morning on your going to the margins, again, you've got a core purpose written right here. And it sounds like you're doing a lot of work. So everybody knows that for right now, this is the core purpose we're going to focus on. We're going to focus on it here, and we're going to focus on it here. You're going to bring feedback. I mean, it's moving through the system. That's really the point. The second one is the resilience systems deal in real-time data and feedback. And we're going to talk about What are the good sources or better sources for real-time data? What kind of data? What kind of feedback? But resilient systems don't just kind of roll along and assume that, you know, whatever. They're constantly getting some kind of feedback. And to your point, resilient systems foster an adaptive capacity, which means they are willing to sort of, as our GPSs endlessly do, recalibrate. We're going to recalibrate. We got some data. We got some data we didn't expect. We got some feedback we didn't expect, which means we're going to recalibrate. And if we don't have this built in, this ability to sort of like, whoa, that here's some new information. And I was thinking when Erwin was preaching this morning, how some of that data really is, are we paying attention to where God is on the move? You know, that's real-time data. Are we paying attention to that? Because that actually would invite us you know, maybe to be a little more adaptive about the directions we're taking or how we're taking those directions. And finally, build strong community. So resilient congregations, resilient conferences, resilient worshiping communities really attend to what it is to be community. Now, in some ways, so he's talking about all kinds of situations. He's not necessarily talking about faith communities. In some ways, we would look at this and we could say, we've got this aced, right? I mean, this should be a definition of who we are. And yet, we've got stuff to learn. I love to think about this in terms of Acts 15. That's kind of my hallmark story for developing a resilient community. So as I say that and you look at these, what is it about Acts 15 that comes to mind?
Huge unexpected challenge.
Huge unexpected challenge. And what was the challenge?
Gentiles wanting to be part of the Jesus Jewish community.
Right. And not just wanting to be part of it, right? I mean, what on earth was going on in those Gentile communities? They were actually healing people and doing miracles and praying to Jesus. Like, wow, that's really a shocker. Right? Yeah. So we have to really think about what our core purpose is when we gather in Jerusalem. We have to really think about our identity when we hit that. We'll come back to that. So this core purpose piece, again, is something that we, I think, generally feel, well, let me ask it. Let me not assume it. How many of you, if I asked you a core purpose for your ministry, could name it to me? Okay, maybe about half to a third of you. Yeah. How many of you, if I sat with your governing body, could give me the core purpose in your congregation? A couple of you? Right. But three different ones, right. And that's not unusual, right? And we may think we have one. So you may think we have one like this, right? But the reality is, this is a big mouthful. So calling it going to the margins is, you know, kind of sums it up for you. So having that sense of core purpose makes the idea of being resilient, because you know what you're coming back to. You know about how you're going to make financial decisions, even hard financial decisions. You might not even agree on those financial decisions, but you agree that somehow we're going to get to this purpose. We're going to work on this purpose. You know, you may have a lot of conversations about worshiping styles or music or what's going on in the kitchen. But when people come back to this core purpose, we may not agree on how to get there, but we come together around this core purpose. So it's essential that somehow this core purpose be something that we all know what it is. And one of so the good news is, you know, essentially as faith people, we have one. The bad news is that generally we put it in many, 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 many words. And we put it in many, 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 many words that we have used over and over again to the point that they don't really have much punch to them. Because they're just kind of our church words. We put it in a lot of church words. So I encourage, I like to work with this piece from a guy named Jonathan Haidt, and he wrote a book called The Happiness Hypothesis that was quoted in a book by Chip and Dan Heath called Switch, How to Change Things. And he talks about how when we're communicating our key purpose, when we're really trying to get our message communicated, we have to keep in mind the elephant and the rider. So when you think about the elephant and the rider, who's in charge? The rider? You've got to vote for the rider.
Depends on how afraid the elephant is.
Right. So the rider certainly thinks he's in charge. We'll give you that. The rider thinks he's in charge. But in fact, if the elephant isn't well trained, or, I don't know, just woke up in a mood that day, it's not going to happen, right? So there has to be something between them. And so generally when we begin to talk about our key purpose, we are generally communicating primarily with the rider part of our brains. So Jonathan Haidt says, you know, if we think about our brains in very, you know, brains for dummies kind of terms, we have an elephant and we have a rider. And the rider is the very small part, the very small part in the front. And the rider is the majority of what goes on in our brain. And the rider, in most of us, we talk rider to rider a lot of the time, right? We're constantly, there was a lot of rider to rider talk today, right? I mean, it was a lot of, you know, analysis. So, because the rider likes to think clearly. The rider is visionary, right? The rider's up there and can see where we're going, kind of has the big picture. The rider likes to analyze situations and identify key problems and issues. Like, it's a really, you know, it's really kind of, we get that. We talk that way. I believe the word brainiac was used earlier. You know, there's that sense of, and we often talk about our key purpose in a very rider way. Right? Are you with me? Okay. It's getting to be noon, so you don't know about, thank heavens, I don't have to worry about your blood sugar. So usually when we're talking about key purpose, we are working at the level of the rider. However, if we really want that key purpose to move through the system, we also need to communicate with the elephant. Now, the elephant is deeply loyal. That part of our brain, it will go along. You know, the 300-year history means something to the elephant. Has a lot of energetic drive. So that part of our brain will carry through some of the commitment and the motivation. That part of our brain is deeply compassionate and is motivated by feelings with a good story. So when you want to get that core purpose, so when Erwin was preaching and we were watching Paul's journey of transformation. He physically was helping us walk through it with that scripture. That was an elephant conversation. We could begin to get that feeling of who Paul was from that story. It moved us just from our head hearing particular texts to the heart of the person. So when we want to say, going to the margins, a story about who we eat with, who we say no to eating with, whose food we want and whose food we don't want, which is, you know, a central question in the early gospel, that we then heard again today. When we hear that, that really, again, speaks to that elephant part of us. That's a story. We get inspired. We can feel that. We feel the compassion. So when we're working on key purpose, we want to be doing both. See, at their worst, the rider gets paralyzed by choices. The rider can see so much so that if you're in a meeting and there's like lots and lots of choices, the riders just start going in circles. You've probably had this. They start spinning their wheels. They can't decide. They get very dry and dull. I don't know if any of your meetings get dry and dull, but Presbyterians are like known for being dry and dull. And that at their worst, the rider has a relentless focus on problems rather than solutions. So when the rider gets activated, this is the way it goes. Maybe at some of your conference meetings this happens. At our presbytery meetings, it happens a lot. The riders in the room just all start going. At their worst, and then the elephants get freaked. They get fearful and resistant. So when there's a fear moment, that elephant, so if you're having a financial discussion around the table and there's a lot of choices going on and you're focusing on the problems, it can kick up the fear in the elephants. What happens to elephants when they're afraid? They stampede, right? And what happens when an elephant stampedes? Stuff gets messed up. So you may... And it may be that you actually experienced somebody stampeding out of something, but you could also experience it in the meeting itself when that elephant part gets activated. The other thing that will happen, and I think this happens in our congregational life, that our elephants are not attended to and they get demoralized and they quit. There's really nothing here for me. There's nothing here for me anymore. And I'm not inspired by a good story. I don't feel the compassion. The other thing elephants are that they're easily derailed. They really need the riders to help them stay going, but that can be one of those, yeah, you've all had that experience. And they go for short-term satisfaction. So I always say if you're working on a strategic plan, and you know our elephants and our riders both, like I've worked with people where I do this and they're like, oh, those elephants. No, we all have an elephant, right? We all get demoralized and want to quit. You know, we all would like some short-term. We all have a rider that needs to sort of see a vision and have a plan. So, I mean, we're always working with both. But I always say when you're beginning to do a strategic plan, you want to build in some early peanuts, right? Because the elephant part of us really is not in it for the long haul. If you say, you know, 2 years from now, this is going to be awesome. The elephant part of us is like, 2 years? Like, I got to hang out in this for 2 years? So how do we build in some of those short term? So again, when you're thinking about your core purpose, when you're thinking about if you're going to take going to the margins as your core purpose, what does that mean in terms of rider talk and elephant talk? Right? So some of you are nodding. Given the time, I won't ask us to go to tables. I'll just ask, so what begins to come up for you when I say that? When I say, as you're thinking about going to the margins, what's the rider talk and what's the elephant talk as you think about that? You're nodding.
I think the rider talk is the question of what is our core purpose in going to the margins? Are we taking the gospel of Jesus to evangelize, or are we doing incarnational ministry? The elephant talk is a story of here is a person or a congregation who went to the margins and this is what it looked like.
Mm-hmm. And it inspires you. Yeah, well, I heard some inspiring conversation this morning. Yeah. Other thoughts about that? As you think about talking core purpose with your own leaders and your own congregation, do you think you tend more towards a story of where we're going or more towards kind of a series of? Right.
What does it mean for within our congregation that X person isn't involved?
Right.
That would be a more short-term thing. What would it look like if it became involved?
So you had some short-term, right. And again, to paint it a picture, so what would it look like if we were to begin to be transformed by this experience on the margins? And a lot of vision. So how do we hold the vision piece of it along with that conviction and maybe that a little bit of that should? Yeah.
The should usually comes in how we get the vision.
Mm-hmm. So I invite you to hold that as you think about the core purpose that you've identified and as you think in your congregational life about how do we take the words, and they're often meaningful words, about what our core purpose is and paint a picture with it. And at times of change, if the elephant isn't attended to, it doesn't matter what the rider does. You know, that's just kind of a keynote for me, that we can have all the great vision and all the best ideas in the world, but if we don't have that part of us that's motivated and that feels pulled, you know, that's willing to get up on that plane, it doesn't matter. And this comes from the Heath brothers. They said that oftentimes when we want people to change, so back to, you know, the work we do to help bring change, we often work with analyze. We think if we analyze it and we think about it and then we move to change. Where, to your really wonderful point, The actual way people are more likely to move to change is to see it and to feel it, and then they want to move towards it. So as we're helping our congregations grasp that, that sense of what is it to really have a life which is on the margins and have that as an understanding of living the gospel, how do they see it and feel it so they can change towards it? Any questions or thoughts or responses? So when we think about resilience, we go back, that really is the piece that roots us. And I love this quote from Howard Thurman, where he says, "As long as we hold a dream in the heart, we cannot lose the significance of living." So dream in the heart. The dream in the heart is one with living water welling up from the very spring of being, nourishing and sustaining all of life. The dream need not be some overwhelming plan. It need not be a dramatic picture of what must be someday. It is not in these grand ways that the dream nourishes life. The dream is that quiet persistence that enables us to ride out the storm of churning experiences. It is the exciting whisper moving through the aisles of the spirit, answering the monotony of limitless days of dull routine. It is the ever-recurring melody in the midst of the broken harmonies of human conflict. It is a touch of significance which highlights the ordinary experience or the common event. So keep alive the dream. For as long as we hold a dream in the heart, we cannot lose the significance of living. So that dream in the heart, I believe, kind of holds what the idea of core purpose for our congregations is for the life of faith, that dream in the heart. It's not just a good idea to go to the margins. It's actually the dream in the heart of God for us to be there. So that's just the piece that I put in to remind us at its best. So then we move to the second piece, which is, what was the second principle? Seeing if everybody's still awake. I know it's been a long morning. Real-time data and feedback. Wow, you guys are brainiacs. So the question is, how do we pay attention to what's happening, and what do we pay attention to? So when I say that, what are some of the things that you know that you pay attention to in terms of data and feedback?
Church attendance and giving and
stuff. Those are our two favorite metrics, aren't they?
How many people are sleeping?
Did people stay awake today? Right. 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 Those are the kind of the classic metrics. Church attendance, church giving. I don't know if you do this. We measure at the end of every year how many new adherents we had, how many baptisms we had. How many people participated in communion and the Lord's Supper. So, you know, just kind of, again, those kind of numbers. What are some of the feedback pieces that you may have been starting to pay attention to that you might think would be more meaningful? Wow. How do you measure that, or how do you pay attention to that?
Depending on the circumstances, part of it may be a healthy family system. Some of it may be individuals that are more devoted to spending time in prayer and Bible studies.
Yes. And I'm hearing also listening for measures of health, for your congregational family? What are the measures that would mean we are deepening in faith and we're also healthy? Yeah.
It's hard for a kid with a good memory just to observe who lost women in the sanctuary. What is the difference in flow and ebb of relationships when everybody's together? It's more of a subjective measure, but there is some objective parts to it just to be observed.
Right. So part of what you're both beginning to identify is when we start to think about data and feedback, the first thing is to identify what kind of feedback we need. So the health, the transformation, how do we begin to think about our people being spiritually transformed? We begin to think about the relational quality and how do we measure that? How do we look at that? It's not just absence of conflict, right? It's really are people communicating? When a visitor comes, is that person greeted, and are they invited in? I mean, what are the ways in which we get that kind of health feedback?
Meaningful feedback is when someone says, because of your message, I changed my behavior. I actually tried something different. One member said, I had to talk to my boss, and your message empowered me to be able to address my boss in a different way.
Wow. That's fantastic feedback. So the feedback we can get from congregants, it's something that you said or in your message really made a difference. And I'm going to riff off that for a minute, because I really want you all to hear that. That's important feedback. And what's our usual tendency when we get that feedback? Well, maybe you all aren't like me. You say amen? Most pastors I know flies right past them. Flies right. Like, that sermon was so meaningful today. Lost that. Five people say something meaningful, something deep, and one person says, I just really was terrible today. And which one do you remember? Right? You go home and you chew over the negative one, and that important feedback really gets lost. It really falls through the cracks. We are wired for this to happen. We are physiologically, our nervous systems are wired for us to pay attention to the negative and to ignore the positive. So these positive pieces of feedback, you have to intend to take them in. You have to intend, just like you did, to hold it, and to repeat it, and to really let it sink in. It takes 10 seconds. They've done research. It takes 10 seconds to allow the positive to sink in. So to try to remember that, maybe you write it down. You remember the person saying it to you. You remember the warmth in your heart or the feeling that you had, and you really take that in. The only way we get rewarded is not just our paycheck, it's also the meaningfulness. We're in this to be meaningful, but you have to be willing to take it in yourselves and to help your congregations do that as well, to take in what's going well. So the feedback isn't just watching the lines go down or focusing on the problems we're having. Part of the feedback is to really notice where God is on the move. So that question that Erwin asked early, what is God doing in our midst, is I think an essential question about feedback. Are we paying attention to the places where things might be happening which aren't in the usual or aren't the problem that we've been focusing on, right? Like all of a sudden, I was working with a client who said, all of a sudden, there are all these children in worship. But they were so worried about something happening to the building that nobody was attending to the fact that actually children were showing up, and what do we want to do about that? And we don't even have a nursery. But nobody's attending to where God is on the move because we're worried about this building campaign we're doing, and everybody's fussing about it, and that's what we're talking about to the side. So it's noticing. I mean, that's a small thing, but there are places all the time where God is on the move in our communities. One of the pastors was sharing a support group they're doing, and noticing what's on the move there, what's open for us. So part of data is, what are we tracking? What are we intending to track? What do we need to track? Right? Any other?
I think it's important to ask for feedback.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's a great, it's important to ask for feedback. So then the question comes, who do you ask? I had another client who was in their worship committee. This is just so classic. They were really concerned about how many people weren't coming to worship. Really concerned. And why weren't they coming to worship? And so they put together a very serious survey about, you know, worship and how it was and what happened in worship and what you thought of it and this and that. Now remember, they're trying to find out who's not coming to worship. So who did they give the survey to? Everybody in church. Right. Everybody in church. So who you ask for feedback from, if you want to know how you're doing as a church, you don't ask the people in the pews. You know, you go to the Panera and the high school and, you know, who we get feedback from. And then you said the second thing, and then what do we do with it? Right. Yeah.
I pay attention to how people respond to needs. And mm. Two aspects of that. One would be state of needs.
Right.
Somebody has shared something, we've shared it. But I pay as much attention to, I know something that's not necessarily public, but I see people in a congregation paying attention to that need because they found out about it.
Right. Again, that's a great metric that people are caring for one another, and again, about the health of congregation and faith. So just in terms of questions, what kind of data do you need? If you're, you know, to serve your core, and again, we come back to what's your core purpose? Because that's really the kind of, where do you get it? And how often? You know, is it enough to do it once a year? Is it enough to do it every 3 years? Is it enough to do it once a month? And who's your best source? So these are the questions. And then what are your obstacles for gathering feedback? So this is a place, but a resilient congregation will be continually getting some kind of feedback and paying attention to it. Right? So the third is foster an adaptive capacity. And he's got a lot on this in the book about what that means. And I'm going to talk about three pieces. He talks about warm zones of diversity. Just, you know, I think it's a phrase. Does anybody know that phrase? Did he cook that up? I think he did. But we'll talk about what that means. And then flexibility, which has already been mentioned here. And then the habits of mind, stress hardiness, and that's really for the leadership. So the zones of diversity that he talks about is that a resilient organization is simple at the core and diverse at the edges. So what does it mean to be diverse at the edges and simple at the core when you think of your congregation? Right, yeah, I don't think that, right. So, that's probably not exactly it. Right, so one of the things you want to do is kind of develop a strong core that is in some ways reflective of that, holds some of that diversity, right? I think some of it is also about how easy it is to know, again, not being the center of all things, but where, how things begin to move through. Again, I think some of that is purpose. You can have a lot of, you can have a common purpose that's simple, that people know where you are, and then have lots and lots of ways to live it out. Different people. And I heard a conversation about four different congregations in one, nobody being a majority. That's diverse, but there's a sense of the core being that congregation. So one of the things we know, yeah.
I'm trying to understand.
Right.
There wouldn't necessarily be diverse at the core of that either.
Right, not at all.
The idea being if there's less, well, no, it would be, because then at the core there's a lot of things that you need to have this whole laundry list.
Exactly. Exactly.
So simple at the core means there's one or two things that put you at the core, which actually allows for a lot of diversity.
Right. And the core doesn't mean power hub. right? I think it's much more about what's central to the organization. So some of it might be how we're governed, but some of it also might be basically we know what we believe, we know what we're about, we're able to move in that direction. Yeah. Nice, nice. So what would be an example of that? Yeah.
Well, if it's identity, then I don't really listen to people who don't look like me. Or
right.
Don't think like me. Or
right.
Don't have the politics that I do. If it's the story we're sharing, but the story is interesting.
Well, and that also takes me back again to Acts 15. So the story at the, what was the center, what was the simple center that they came back to? Jesus is Lord. Jesus is Lord. That was about as simple as it got. And because of that, they could be diverse at the edges. So, you know, you all practice the way you want to, and you, I guess, will let Paul go do his thing, and, you know, this group will be much more conservative in what they allow and what they don't allow, but we have this central piece at the core. It takes a lot to allow diversity, right? It takes a lot for us to allow it, because it can feel chaotic or it can feel uneven. But in fact, one of the things that he goes to nature to look at is that a system becomes more resilient when it has more diverse systems feeding it. And he looks at what happens in nature. And you all probably know this from your own work. What happens when a system really becomes homogeneous? Much more vulnerable, right? Yeah. And the more diversity we allow in and build in, so we've created a culture that really almost privileges that kind of just everything being the same, and we're much more vulnerable that way than really allowing lots and lots of difference. That's what makes us more resilient, is that how do we in our congregational life become more resilient? What are the diverse streams that feed into our congregational life? Any examples? We've had the example of the four different congregations in one. Any other examples where the diverse streams are feeding in?
I see that in music and worship a lot.
Okay, music and worship, right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, again, we say these things like they're simple. We should have more diversity. And what we begin to experience is the process actually is, you know, it's not that we're getting to someplace. Allowing the process of diversity is what makes us resilient. It's not that it's a means to an end. The process of being, as somebody said, uncomfortable and vulnerable, to allow that is really what begins to create it. But it's hard. It is hard. Any other examples of where diversity has, allowing diversity, seeing that come in? Right.
There's a willingness. And when it's level ground, that everyone, no matter what their opinion, education, experience, et cetera, all look upon it to be able to bring into the system some value.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about joy, I'm doing cultural, you know, difference. But it does take a word to surrender. And the other part I would say is being willing.
That's so hard, isn't it? Yeah. Yes. You can't have it all your way. That's really allowing the diversity is a big part of it. And that spectrum of ages is another place where it's hard. You can't always have your own way. How do we allow that? I mean, that's a place of a lot of. When we do this, we're working against groupthink, that confirmation bias, like, oh, we all think this. So someone at our table said, you know, to begin with going to the margins, you have to begin to think about what your own lens is. You know, we all have a lens that we bring about right or wrong, good or bad, how this should work, that willingness to let go of it in these difficult conversations. And so, to your point, that cognitive diversity. So it's not just about socioeconomic or racial, ethnic or cultural. It's also about ideas. And it may also be about theology, ecclesiology. Those can be some of the points that feel more difficult for us.
Do you have any suggestions on, let's just say hypothetically, some, I can imagine churches in the room here. Let's just imagine some.
A Presbyterian church, yeah.
Let's just imagine a Presbyterian church who, when you talk about, well, it sounds great until you bring up the lot of diversity. And then
right.
People get very uncomfortable.
You bet.
Any suggestions on how to help navigate that? You know, I hear you saying diversity helps make us stronger.
For me, it's going back to the early gospel in the New Testament. And it's really asking us to sit with what, and I think it's hard for us to kind of even get into those shoes, but to sit with and to realize what was encouraged and permitted, which was not a group think, this is how we do it, but it was really an amazing variety of different ways to experience the gospel, really until the second century, different ways to experience the gospel. And what did that mean? You know, what did it cost, but also what did it offer? And to help people sort of sit, you know, detached from where they are right now, to go into the biblical story and to live with that. The other way we work on it is, again, a lot of table conversation. A lot of table conversation about what really is essential and what, you know, can we boil it down to the most essential and how do we act like Christians with one another? We're having a lot of trouble with that as Presbyterians. We're having a lot of trouble. Yeah, the elephants are stampeding. Any other thoughts or questions?
Part of that thing about seeking data, and been hearing some of Diana Butler Bass talk about from her book Grounded, about the millennials seem to get this diversity piece in ways that, but they're not there.
But they might be there on Thursday night if we could figure, you know.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So where are we getting, how do we listen to them?
Right.
And in ways that don't feel patronizing to them, that invite them into the population.
Right. So again, that's a great opportunity to say, so the diversity, how do we invite people in who actually are comfortable with it and really swim in that water to help us do that? Yeah. Piece of the work. So there's respectful challenge and supportive dissent. How do we have that in our conversations? And this is the stress. So this is the stress hardiness piece, and I spend an entire time on working through this, but for those of us, it's our habits of mind as well that make a difference for this. In terms of that adaptive, the ability to be adaptive, that's the over. So part of diversity helps us be adaptive, flexibility helps us be adaptive, and working on our own stress hardiness, which is believing that I can influence events, you know, not having a feeling that I'm a victim or I'm disempowered by this. And that's as true for our congregations as it is for us as leaders. Belief of meaningful purpose in life. All this work comes back again to our core peace. And the belief that positive and negative experiences lead to learning and growth. And again, I believe that's woven into faith, but it is certainly not woven into our culture that believes that if I have a difficult experience, it's bad, and if I have a positive experience, it's good. But we really understand that fullness of what suffering can mean. And again, I think we have such a central story to tell in these times. So our resilience matters. And again, staying in social networks and community. And the final piece he talks about, again, I think we have a lot of this, is building a strong community where there's trust, where there's cooperation, and where there's collaboration. And so again, the more we can encourage that in our congregations and in our leadership teams, and for you in the conference with one another, because I also think it's multiplicative when you all are in those kinds of relationships, and it deepens your resilience to go in and do your leadership. So that community and events like this, like today, are a large piece of that. So those are the four practices. Let's remember them again. Core purpose, real data and feedback, adaptive capacity, and strong community. Look at that. That's great. So I put together a piece that is an opportunity for you to just sort of do your own audit of looking at these, you know, just for your own reflection. I think what I'd like to do is just invite you to take about 10 minutes and look at it and maybe just share for a few minutes at your tables, and then we will conclude. We have them? Somebody has them. Great. So this is just something for you to just reflect on a few minutes as you think about your own, you know, what might be a strength where you are and what might be a growing edge. So let's come back together. I hate to stop the conversation. I hate to stop the conversation. It was the energy was very lively, but just any insights or thoughts or pieces you want to just share quickly before we close out?
We had an interesting conversation about how this longevity of pastoral leadership fit in with flexibility and health and all that.
It's a great conversation, and I hope you keep having it, because I don't think it's a simple answer. Right? Yeah, I don't think it's just as simple, but I mean, I do think that's a factor on the positive building resilience side and also on the spending it downside. So, yeah. Other thoughts? Or?
I think it's important that your steps actually are sequential, and if you don't have a core purpose, then the rest of them don't make a difference.
That's right. And that's exactly right. Right.
And then you can become adaptive and become all people to all things, but that core purpose firmly in shape.
Exactly. It really is. That really is the central piece, again, is, and that the core purpose is known throughout the whole system. So, you know, you don't have a group over here who thinks their core purpose is this and our core, but again, that it's there. Yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts or...
Communicating that,
right?
We're really kind of blowing it as leaders.
Great. And so, and I think that's really important because, again, the data isn't just for this little, you know, but how do we share that data and feedback so the whole system can learn from it? Yeah, it's great.
Do you have to explain that picture to people who are not Anabaptist, Mennonite, Amish, whatever?
No, and in fact, I realized this morning that that was the picture that was in there, and I thought, well, I hope that's, you know, is that culturally insensitive, you know, to have that picture in there? I did think about sneaking out and changing it. Well, we don't have a lot of things that really show. It's hard to have a picture that shows real collaborative community around a common purpose that's not, you know. So, I mean, you know. Good. Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Anything else?
Stories actually give voice and vision to what our values are.
Right.
And we can say this is our value, but unless we actually give some flesh and blood examples of it, it's meaningless.
Right. And so again, values matter to the rider, and then painting the picture of that matters to that elephant part of us, speaks to us so the whole self can be there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you all. It's just been delightful to be with you and meet you and be even a small part of your good work. So thank you, and I'll hand it back.